All right, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Chabad and Coffee in Jeff's place at Chabad in town on the Beltline in Atlanta, Georgia. We have so many different ways to describe this place, but it's great to see everyone. Okay, so today our topic is how to become a prophet, or how to prophet. I'm kidding, how to be a prophet. You know, I always told people, that why is it that in the Chabad Yeshiva, we don't study the books of the Navi. We don't study like Ezekiel and Jeremiah. We don't study... One second. As I walk backwards. We don't study it directly. I mean, we study it indirectly, but mainly we focus on other texts and Chassidic texts and mystical texts. So the punchline is because, Chabad is a non-profit. You had to be there. Anyway, but today we're gonna talk about prophecy because the core question is the following, and you'll see soon how we're gonna tie this into our broader discussion. The core question is, how does God communicate to a prophet? Does God communicate to a prophet? I'll give you a spoiler alert. We're gonna posit that yes, God does communicate with prophets and has communicated with prophets, and there is a thing called prophecy. But the real question is, how does that happen? Like, how does that go down? Does God speak to the prophet? That's slightly, problematic, because if God is speaking to a prophet, that implies that God has a mouth. God has a voice. Does God have a mouth? If God has a mouth, does God have a body? Does God look like a human being? This raises a whole host of issues. Now, we know that Judaism teaches, and this is found not only in Kabbalah, this is found straight up in many different texts, many different scriptural texts that allude to this, many texts in the Talmud, the Medrash, Maimonides writes about this, that God does not possess a body, nor does God possess any semblance of human form. So if God doesn't have a body, if God doesn't possess human form, then how is God speaking? How is God seeing? How is God, what's the language that we use on Passover? God rescued us with his outstretched arm. Really? God, what, its massive arm descended from the heavens to scoop us out? So what's going on here? So that's part of what we're going to talk about today. How does God actually communicate with prophets? What is prophecy? What does that look like? What does that feel like? What is that experience like? So we'll talk about that in a moment. But first, before we get there, let's talk about the context. Last week, we explained something pretty incredible, where the Alter Rebbe in this second part of the Book of Tanya, he explains that the philosophers made a big mistake because they equated creation of heaven and earth with the creation that human beings do. And he says they're fundamentally different, although again the philosophers equated the two. He says, when it comes to the creation that you and I do, so you're creating something from something. You're not creating something from nothing. You start with something and you modify it to something else. You take an existing substance, an existing chemical, an existing mineral, an existing thing, piece of matter, and you transform it, and you manipulate it, and you modify it into something else. So it's yesh, miyesh, something from something else. So when it comes to something from something, you don't need to be around the whole time. Right? You took something, you took a big piece of wood, you carved out, I don't know, what are you carving out from wood?
A canoe.
I love it. You carve out a canoe from a piece of wood, and you can walk away, and the canoe it's still there, it still exists. Because you didn't fundamentally grant it existence, all you did was you took wood and you shaped it, you carved it out into a canoe. So it doesn't need you to exist. It doesn't need you for its basic definition of existence. Whereas, God's creation of the universe, which is something being created from abject nothingness. It's not that God took an existing... another happy, satisfied customer at our Hebrew school. I'm sure we're working on it. Okay, God didn't take an existing matter and reconfigure it into a universe. God created all of this something from absolute nothingness. And therefore, he says, last week, we said this, that when you create something from nothing, you have to stick around. Because a thing always reverts to its pre-existing state. So the nature of all somethingness that we see is really nothingness. And therefore, right, since the nature of this existence is nothing, God has to constantly power it into being, into somethingness, for it to continue going. Otherwise, it would revert into nothing. It's like light. You need light to be constantly on in order for it to be on. It's like you throw a football into the air. You need to have that force pushing it into the air, or else it'll fall down. In other words, a thing is always reverting back to its nature. Without God constantly powering existence into being, it wouldn't exist. It would revert to nothingness. And as he said a few weeks ago, it would actually, its entire history, not only its present and future would be eliminated, but even its past would be absolutely eliminated and disappear. Yeah.
Well, there's a law of physics that states matter can neither be created nor destroyed by any means known to man. So, it's out of our hands.
So that's, again, that's presupposing that matter is matter. But if you look through the Kabbalistic lens, matter is nothing but nothingness being imagined into being at this moment, or being breathed into existence at this moment. Now, once it exists, so now you have other laws, natural laws that take hold. But what Kabbalah teaches is, at its core, all matter at any moment is really blinking in and out of existence. Whereas it God is making it exist, and then if God wouldn't continue making it exist, it would unexist. I know that's not a word, but work with me, right? It would cease to exist. Then God has to make it exist again, cease to exist, make it. So everything is constantly being recreated, revivified into being. So that's how he explains the need for God's words. And again, this is where we get into language, and does God actually speak, and how does prophecy work? We'll get there in a moment. But God constantly speaks or powers existence into being. At every moment, God's words, this is the opening verse of this text, God's words are constantly standing firm in the heavens. Without God's words, let there be light. Let there be heavens, let there be vegetation, let there be an ocean, let there be sun, moon, and stars. Without that, nothing would exist. You need that constant revivification, it's recreation happening. But again, the core idea here that we started last week, that we're going to continue this week, and as we explore prophecy, we'll touch on this as well. The core idea is that there's a fundamental difference when you start with something and you modify it into something else, or when you start with nothing and you're trying to create something. The latter type of creation is the only true definition of creation. Otherwise, it's just forming or reforming or changing something. It's not really creating. In other words, the true definition of creation is that you're making something new from nothing. Why is that the true definition? Well, that's what he says the true definition of creation is. When the Torah says, Bereshit, bara Elohim, in the beginning God created, bara created means from nothing. Right? You walk in a room and there's nothing, and then you start creating. And that's not even a good example, because even when you walk in a room, there's still something. Right? Imagine nothing. Now, we can't imagine nothing, because we started post something. Our origin begins in a world of something. We emerge, right? That's my trailer voice. I don't know if you Okay, so we exist post-creation. In other words, we exist in the world of some things. We're also part of that something. We can't imagine a world of nothing. But imagine, try to imagine, try to strip out everything that exists, nothing, 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 and then create. It's like an impossibility. And so the Alter Rebbe says, if that's what you're dealing with, then you constantly need that force, that underlying creative force, to constantly power things into creation. Which is why he says that the philosopher's approach, that God or some sort of original cause, prime mover, first cause, whatever it is, that some sort of God started all this off and then let it go, makes no sense. What they did was they projected human creation onto God. And they said, I can create a painting and I can walk away. So certainly God created the universe and walked away. Or floated away, or whatever God would do to go away. He says that's fundamentally flawed. It's flawed logic. Because you're applying human forms of creation to God, and it's a completely different ballgame. Because a human being that can walk away from something that they've created, it's because they took something that already existed before them. You took something that predated yourself. So of course it doesn't need you to exist. You took a piece of wood from a tree that was planted or that grew before you were born, perhaps. Or certainly existed before you touched it at this moment to cut it, to carve it into the canoe. And so you took something that existed without you prior to your involvement. Of course it can continue to exist without you after your involvement. But when you talk about creation of heaven and earth, which is by definition an absolute paradox of impossibility, that something should be in the place of nothingness, it's impossible. That should be the reality is something that constantly needs, that impossibility constantly needs to be put into motion. Make sense? So, it's so impossible for any of this to be, because the natural state of all of this is nothingness. So for any of this to exist is like a living, breathing, existing paradox. When I say paradox, I mean you have in the place of nothing, there's something. It shouldn't be. It's a possible impossibility that is only possible if God is constantly making that impossible possible. You know, there was one place on earth where you could see the impossibility of existence. The Talmud says that in the Holy of Holies, in the Beit HaMikdash, in the Holy Temple, so let's explain. Back in the day, going back 2,000, 2,500 years ago, 3,000 years ago, there was a holy temple in Jerusalem. Before that, there was a tabernacle that traveled around. At the center of the temple, there was a chamber, a room, where no one walked in, except for the high priest on the holy day of Yom Kippur. One person, one day, one space, that was it. The rest of the time, it was off limits. What was in the Holy of Holies? What was in the center of the Holy of Holies? The Ark housing the tablets. Good. Right? Raiders of the Lost Ark, remember? Who was that, Harrison Ford? Yeah. So before the Nazis got it, or however that story, you know, played out. So it was in the Holy of Holies. We actually had a class about that. Remember we did Secrets of the Lost Ark? According to Jewish sources, it never got out. They buried it before the temple was destroyed. Anyway, and our tradition has it that it's still buried underground till this very day. Anyway, let's get back to the Holy of Holies. So it was called that space, in which was this box, this ark, this holy ark, which housed the tablets, both set of tablets, the original ones that Moses broke, which were in pieces, and the second tablets that were carved to replace the first ones. So that space that housed the ark with the tablets was called the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies. So there was a space that was called holy, but this is like the holy of the holies, the most holy space. And it was a room that had a certain dimension. I don't remember the exact dimension right now. And again, in the center of the room was an ark. So imagine, so this table, look at this. We may or may not need to water that. Okay. Don't water that, please. I don't. Just roll right off the plastic. Okay. So here, we'll do a visual thing. So this is actually a separate table. Where's the table? Here's the table. Oh, right over here. Okay, so imagine this is the room, right? Right here is the room. This is going to play really well on the podcast. So we have a space with a room, and then in the center of the room, you have the ark. Let's just use some round numbers here. Imagine if the dimensions of the room, if it was 10 wide. So from here to here, right, the width of the room was 10 amo, 10 cubits, which is about 30 feet. So 10 cubits from here to here. Okay, great. You measure the ark, 2.5 cubits wide. 2.5 wide. Good. So you would imagine that if you measure from here to here, from the edge of the room to this side of the ark, and from this from the other side of the ark to the edge of the room, you would get, what's 7.5 divided by 2? 3.25, right? So 3.25 cubits here and 3.25 cubits there, plus the 2.5 equals 10. Our math is done for this morning. Thank you for joining us. Now, however, you with me? Make sense? The numbers may be off. But whatever. Listen, we're super close, right? We're super close. Either way. Oh, right, it should be 3.75, not 3.25. 3.75. Okay, good. Now, let's move on. So here's what we do. But here's how it actually played out. If you measure from the edge of the room to the edge of the ark, it was 5. And you measure from the other side of the ark to the edge of the room, it was also 5. So the whole room was 10. Until the ark and past the ark was also 10. But you measure the ark, it had space, 2.5. Which led our sages to coin the following phrase, Makom ha'aron, eino min hamida. The space of the ark didn't take up space. It didn't say, the Talmud doesn't say, the ark didn't take up space. It says the space of the ark didn't take up space, because it did have space. It had its own space. If you measured it, it had space. It had space, and yet the space didn't take up space. It doesn't say that it didn't contain space. It was invisible. That would imply that it didn't exist. We couldn't see it. You could see it. You could measure it. But its space didn't take up space. So the way Kabbalah explains this Talmudic passage is that here you have the convergence of space and non-space, or in our terms, existence and non-existence, or limitation and non-limitation, residing in the very same entity. So to talk about dimensions that are within space and dimensions that are beyond space, that even that we can wrap our heads around. This dimension is limited by time and space. There's a dimension out there that's not limited by time and space. That we can wrap our heads around a little bit easier. But the Talmud is saying something else. In one given space, there was both space and non-space at the very same time. Convergence of space and non-space. Go figure. That's the paradox. Where you find paradox, you find God. Because only God is the master of paradox. We certainly couldn't pull that stuff off, right? So where you find the paradox is where you find God's essential power. The power of transcendence that is both transcendent and immanent at the same time. So we have a space that is space, it's beyond space, in the same contained, non-contained space. Go figure. So you have an entity, the ark, that is limited by space, and it transcends space, and it coexists together. The truth is, the ark, which was at the epicenter of the temple, is really a teaching, it's really a pedagogical tool to teach us about the rest of existence. in the Kabbalistic understanding. Because the rest of existence is really the same thing. It takes up space. It exists within time. So limited by time and space. But in essence, it's only being powered by God out of nothingness at this very moment, which means that at its core, it doesn't have to be. And at its core, it doesn't exist until God at this moment reimagines it or revivifies it, recreates it at this moment. So even within everything within creation, not only the ark, you also have this duality of existence and non-existence at the very same time. Does it make sense? Sort of? Ish?
It's coming. No, yeah.
Okay. Good. Listen, if it made perfect sense, it would be a little...
Well, we're being asked to imagine the unimaginable.
Exactly. And imagine the unimaginable at the same time... Exactly, which is why it was a trick question. Aha! Okay, now let's talk about how to become a prophet. You ready? This is with an F. Prophet like Gil.
Right.
How to levitate is next week. How to become a prophet is this week. Okay, becoming a prophet. By the way, I love what I did. By Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon. Who's Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon? Maimonides, right? Rambam, Maimonides. Maimonides lived in the 1100s. He was the famous. He originally came from Spain. When things got hectic in Spain with the rise of the Almohads, which were a very radical Islamic group, so they fled for safety. They went to North Africa. The family fled to North Africa, and then they went across North Africa to Egypt, and Maimonides settled in Egypt, where he became the royal physician. Fascinating story about Maimonides. Does everyone have a copy of this, Becoming a Prophet? Are we short?
No, it's not in the book.
He thought
this
it was
separate.
In the book.
Yeah, no. You see that? I'm mixing things up on you. I did. Usually you're like, I don't need copies, but today we all need copies. I need a copy also. Anyway, Maimonides was originally supported by his brother. His brother was a businessman who dealt with like shipping, you know, buying and selling, a good Jewish vocation. You buy low, sell high. Hey, what could go wrong? You want the prophecy thing?
Yeah.
I'm thinking we only have copies around the table. I don't have any more. Do we have an extra copy?
Last
extra. You have one, Erica, right?
Yes, sir.
Perfect. Okay, so Maimonides was originally supported by his brother. His brother one day got lost at sea and never returned. His brother seems like his ship sank or whatever it was. Back in the day, you know, people disappeared. Whatever. No, I'm serious. Like people that went out, traveled and went out to sea, they would often disappear, and there would be no way to know. But either way, so Maimonides had to get a job. He had to support himself because he was the scholar, and his brother was the businessman, and his brother would send money to support Rambam, Maimonides. And when that stopped, this is what happened. He read books on medicine. This is literally what happened. He was just a scholar, Torah scholar. He read books on medicine, and he became a physician. He went, he printed out his own certificate thing. doc.com, no. Anyway, so he printed out, he didn't print out anything. He was the most incredible physician. There's so many stories about his cures and his approach to medicine. In fact, he wrote various texts, Maimonides did, on health. He wrote on how to take care of the body and various elements of health. And he continued to write prolifically and to teach and to practice medicine. He writes a famous letter. It's famous because it's been published many times. He wrote a letter to somebody about his daily schedule. He says he wakes up early in the morning and he goes to the royal palace and he's the royal physician. And he's there till afternoon and then he goes home. And then he gets home. And by the time he gets home, there's a line around the block from the Jewish community, people who want some medical help. You know, like if you're a doctor, and if you're a Jewish doctor, and you go, let's say, to synagogue, the next thing you know, everyone's like, you know, I got this thing. Can you, right? It's always like that. You know the story about the doctor who goes over to the lawyer. He says to the lawyer, like, I don't know what to do. Every time I go to the synagogue, to shul, like people are always asking this, they need this help, that help, the other help. Like, I don't know what to do. Like, I don't mind dispensing help, but it takes all my time and everything. So the lawyer says, listen, do what I do. He says, I give them the answer. I help them. And then Monday morning, I send out a bill in the mail. I send out an invoice. The doctor says, it's a great idea. Tuesday morning, he gets an invoice from the lawyer. Anyway, so by the time he got home, there was a line around the block of people who wanted medical, they wanted to consult with Rambam. Okay. So Rambam, he would excuse himself, go inside, grab something quick to eat, and then he would open up the door and see people. And he said he would see people, and he was so tired at a certain point in the evening that he would be lying down to rest while he was answering their questions and dispensing medical help. So you can imagine, Rambam, poor guy. But that was his schedule. Anyway, he also found time to write prolifically. In fact, to this very day, his Mishneh Torah, 14 volumes of Jewish law, stand as the authoritative resource of Jewish law. He took all of the teachings of Torah, all the teachings of the Mishnah, all of the teachings of the Talmud, which are very scattered and very complicated to study. A lot of disputes and questions and all, very complicated. And he consolidated, well, it's still a massive work, 14 big volumes of Jewish law organized clearly, concisely by categories. And he's unique because there have been other subsequent forms of codes of Jewish law that are based on Rambam, but that apply to other, as things evolve and as new issues come up, you have to write, you have to keep on adding to the law. But none of the subsequent codes of Jewish law talk about all areas of Jewish law. What I mean is, Rambam includes the laws of the sacrifices, the laws of the temple, the laws of ritual purity and impurity, things that are not relevant today, that have not been relevant for the last 2,000 years, since we do not no longer have a holy temple in Jerusalem. But Rambam's Mishneh Torah, 14 volumes, include all of the laws of Judaism, even the ones that in his times had already not been relevant for 1,000 years. But he wrote them, consolidated. So the absolute authority on Jewish law is Rambam. He writes here, this is taken straight up from his Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah, the laws of the foundations, the fundamentals of Torah, chapter 7. This is where it comes from. So let's read how to become a prophet. All right, I'll read. It is one of the foundations of our faith that God communicates by prophecy with man. In other words, with human beings. It's not gender specific. In Jewish history, there have been men that have been prophets. Moses, most famously. There have been women prophets as well. Prophets. Devorah, Yael, various other prophets that have been, women that have been prophets as well. Okay. Prophecy, he continues to say, prophecy is bestowed only upon a very wise sage of strong character, who is never overcome by his natural inclinations in any regard. Instead, with his mind, he overcomes his natural inclinations at all times. So by the way, he doesn't say that a prophet is someone who doesn't have any natural inclinations, but rather someone who may have the natural inclination, but is able to control it with their mind and push it away and not act on that impulse. He must also possess a broad and correct perspective. In other words, the seichel, the mind, has to be clear and has to be, when I say healthy, I don't mean in the classic term of health versus not health, but I mean has to have a very healthy Torah perspective of seichel, of intelligence. A person who is full of all these qualities and is physically sound is fit for prophecy. When he enters the Parades, and here we have Maimonides speaking in somewhat mystical terms, when he enters the Parades, the realm of spiritual knowledge, and is drawn into these great and sublime concepts, if he possesses a correct perspective to comprehend and grasp them, he will become holy. He will advance and separate himself from the masses who proceed in the darkness of the time. He must continue and diligently train himself not to have any thoughts whatsoever about fruitless things or the vanities and intrigues of the times. It's interesting how he mentions twice, he emphasizes, that there is a darkness of the times and vanity and intrigue of the times. In other words, that will always change. Whatever is a waste of time, that always... the truth is consistent. But that which is a distraction always changes. Right? I don't think they had Facebook. I know Facebook could also be a holy experience, and whatever, and that's fine. But the distraction of Facebook, they didn't have in Maimonides' time. So that the vanities of the world change all the time, but the truth is consistent. Instead, his mind should constantly be directed upward, bound beneath God's throne of glory, striving to comprehend the holy and pure forms, and gazing at the wisdom of the Holy One, blessed be He, in its entirety, in its manifold manifestations, from the most elevated spiritual form until the navel of the earth, appreciating His greatness from them. So, clearly, sorry? Right. I feel the same way, which is how I know that I'm not yet on the level of a prophet, because if I could explain this to you, then I could, then perhaps I could tell you, you know, who to bet on for the Super Bowl, but I'm not there yet. I'm still holding out hope for my Steelers. I don't know. It's going to be a tough game today. Yes, Patriots, exactly. Yes, Dave, I know. And that's never worked out for the black and gold. Okay, yeah, but you're right. So what does it mean to gaze at the images beneath the God's throne of glory and comprehend the holy and pure forms and gazing at the wisdom of the Holy One? What it in general terms, it means that a prophet, a true prophet, has the ability to perceive spiritual realities and the physical realities from top to bottom. That's part of the quality of what it is to be a prophet. After these preparations, then, and that's only the preparation stage, then the spirit of prophecy will immediately rest upon him. By the way, it's possible also that even if a person is worthy of prophecy, that they won't be granted prophecy. So it's not a guarantee, even though it sounds like he's writing it as a guarantee. It's not necessarily a guarantee. You know, no promises are being made. Your mileage may vary. Yes.
So as it's written, it's almost as if anyone has the potential.
This is your guide to becoming a prophet. Yeah, okay. Exactly.
So this is not something that is bestowed upon you, but this is something, the prophecy maybe, but anyone.
Yes. Yes. Correct. And if they have, it sounds like also this is a type of person that is gifted in the ability to be in control of their instinct, of their emotions, that they have a strength of mind and a strength of mind that they're able to be in control constantly, and that they have the ability to perceive spiritual realities. And then that precipitates the experience of prophecy.
Well, what do they mean? What's the difference between prophecy and intuition?
So I think what he's saying here is that prophecy, well, and we haven't finished this yet, but prophecy is something where God is directly communicating with the prophet, whereas intuition could be seen as something where a person is kind of picking up on signals that are out there in the universe, right? And gaining an insight into things that exist, as opposed to God sending a message to or through that person. Might be a bit as it's. Yeah. But intuition also could be channeling into something. Look, we once had a speaker speak on premonitions and dreams and that sort of thing, and he asked the question to the assembled crowd. Back at the old place, by raise of hand, who has had this experience or knows someone that has had this experience where you've had a dream about somebody that they passed away, and then shortly thereafter they passed away? And about half the hands went up in the room. And this is something where a person, not necessarily that they were like, you know, imminently going to pass away, but somebody like, it was kind of like out of the ordinary or whatever. Like, I know my grandfather had this experience where he had a dream about somebody passing, like a neighbor passing away, and the next morning they passed away. And it wasn't like they were, you know, sick or whatever it was. It was just like a very random thing. And he said, the explanation is because the soul, our souls are connected to a wellspring of wisdom that's far beyond what our physical brains know. because our brains only know the things that have gone into our head, right? The things that we've read, the things that we've heard, the things that we've seen, like that which has gone through, like literally the holes in our skull, like that which has gone through, so that's what we know. And then we can figure more things out, but that's our information base is what's gone in. But our soul, which is not limited to a physical locale, our soul is way beyond that. Our soul has access to wisdom that's throughout the universe. Not only throughout the world, but throughout universe and time and history and space. So our souls have much more access to that wisdom. Now, typically we operate inside our heads. When we sleep, for example, our souls elevate outside of our bodies a little bit. And they recharge. And the understanding is in Judaism that sleep is a 60th of death. It's a taste of death, which means that if death is a separation of body and soul, it means when we sleep, the soul gets out of the body a little bit and is able to see things. The example that he gave is, imagine if there's something inside a cup, inside the cup. But imagine if it's able to peek out beyond the rim of the cup and look out. It can see a whole new landscape that inside the cup, it only sees inside that very small area. But if it can rise up a little bit, it can see a completely different landscape. So when we sleep, we have the ability to see beyond that. And I would say, you know, premonitions are like that. Dream messages are like that. And maybe intuition is also something like that, where if we're in tune with our soul, we can pick up on ideas that are, or you know, pieces of knowledge and information and clarity that's out there beyond what we intellectually know, perhaps in our heads. But prophecy is slightly different, even though it's somewhat similar, but it's slightly different in that it's a communication from God specifically for the person or for the person to share to others. And that requires, as he's laying out here, requires a very high level of intelligence, clarity of intelligence, and spiritual purity, if you will. Now, let's continue. When the Spirit rests upon him, spirit of prophecy, when the spirit of prophecy rests upon him, his soul becomes intermingled with the angels called Ishim. So now we know there are angels called Ishim. And the prophet, at that time, the spirit becomes intermingled, the soul of the prophet becomes intermingled with the angels called Ishim, and he'll be transformed into a different person and will understand with a knowledge different from what it was previously. In other words, the experience of the spirit of prophecy resting upon a person actually transforms the person's wisdom and understanding and knowledge into a different state than previous. He will rise above the level of other men, of other wise men. As the prophet Samuel told Saul, the Spirit of God will descend upon you, and you shall prophesy with them, and you will be transformed into a different person. That comes from the book of Samuel. Let's continue. There are a number of levels among the prophets. Just as with regard to wisdom, one sage is greater than his colleague. In other words, when it comes to intelligence, people are at different levels of intelligence. Some are smarter, more wise than others. So too, with regard to prophecy, one prophet is greater than the other. In other words, it's not like prophecy is a static reality where if you're a prophet, then that's what you have. Every prophet, Samuel, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Moses, everyone's on a different level. They all, however, share certain commonalities, with the exception of Moses, as will be stated soon in Law number 6. We're up to number 2. In number 6, we'll talk about Moses' prophecy.
Does the prophet trainee realize he's evolving and changing? Or does he just forget what he was and now he knows what he is?
The implication is that there is an awareness of a process happening. And it's not totally unaware, that a person is just totally caught unawares of it. So from Maimonides begins, it seems like the person can kind of drive it themselves. Historically, what's happened, and by the way, you should know, the Talmud says that already from the times of the beginning of the Second Temple era, the era of prophecy has ceased. So Maimonides is talking about historical prophecy. Now, it doesn't mean that there can't be unique, once-off instances of prophecy, but it means as a thing, this whole thing is no longer a thing. that make sense? This was, back in the day, there were prophets. And the reason why I say this is because back when it was a thing, you would have prophets that would train other prophets, disciples, to become prophets. They would kind of mentor them. So like Elijah mentored Elisha, the prophet. You had people who took other prophets under their wings, and sometimes they were just, based on scripture, they were just, you know, God just chose them to be a prophet based on who they were and whatever. But oftentimes they kind of were trained to be a prophet by a prior prophet.
Can we go back on the first page?
Sure. Yeah.
So is there
some sort of transformation happening?
Yeah.
Yeah, and the question is it yesh mi yesh or yesh mi ayin? Is it something from something or something from nothing?
Yeah.
I don't know. Let's continue. Let's find out. Let's see how radical the transformation is. I mean, it seems like it's pretty radical though. Okay, here we go. So now second paragraph on the second page, which is not numbered. But in law number two, second paragraph, he describes what is the experience of prophecy like. They receive prophetic visions only in a visionary dream or during the day after slumber has overtaken them. So either at night or in a daydream-like state. As the verse states, I will make myself known to him in a vision, I will speak to him in a dream, and that comes from the Torah, five books of Moses, the book of Numbers. When any of them prophesy, their limbs tremble, their physical powers become weak, they lose control of their senses, and thus their minds are free to comprehend what they see. As the verse states concerning Abraham, and a great dark dread fell over him. It's interesting. He says, not only is the experience of prophecy overwhelming, that it causes the body to tremble, and it causes a dread, he goes the other way. It's because the body is losing its power that the person is able to channel something so spiritual. In other words, the body in its full conscious state would actually be a barrier to the experience of prophecy for the prophet. Make sense? Okay. Similarly, Daniel states, my appearance was horribly changed and I retained no strength, referring to his experience while having an experience of prophecy. And then here's a commentary on this. Since these prophets' level of refinement is not complete, their conscious minds cannot operate in their normal fashion while they prophesy. The reason why this is important is because we're going to contrast this later with Moses, who is the only prophet in the Jewish tradition, the only prophet to have a prophetic experience while in a regular, full, conscious modality of being. That is why Moses is the one and only unique prophet. No one before him and no one after him had a prophecy like Moses, which we'll describe soon, in that Moses was in a normative state and still was able to have that prophecy. Number three, when a prophet is informed of a message in a vision, it is granted to him in metaphoric imagery. In other words, it's not like straight up, like here's the message. It's metaphoric. Immediately, the interpretation of the imagery is imprinted upon his heart, and he knows its meaning. For example, the ladder with the angels ascending and descending, envisioned by the patriarch Jacob, was an allegory for the empires and their subjugation of his descendants. Let me explain. It says that there were angels. Jacob lies down when he's leaving Israel to go to Haran to find a wife. So he lies down and he has a dream. In the dream, there's a ladder on the ground, stretching up to the heavens, angels going up and angels coming down. Many different ways of understanding it. Rambam, Maimonides, chooses one to describe here. He says the angels going up and down are symbolic of the various nations, world powers, that would rise and destroy Israel and exile and subjugate the Jewish people. But ultimately, as each empire rose, the Roman Empire, the Babylonian Empire, the Roman Empire, each one that would rise, that would ascend the ladder, would also ultimately descend the ladder. So Jacob is having a prophecy, a prophetic vision, before he gets married and before he has the 12 tribes. Right? Before the Jewish people are called B'nai Yisrael, the children of Israel. Before he has any children of his own, he's having a vision of what will happen to his descendants. That they will be subjugated by these great world powers that rise. They'll fall, but another one will rise, and another one will fall, and up and down, and up and down. And ultimately the Jewish people will return. But that's the point. So this is an allegory for the empires. That means the empires that subjugated the Jewish people, and their subjugation of his descendants. Okay, similarly, the creatures Ezekiel saw, the boiling pot and the rod from an almond tree envisioned by Jeremiah. Oh, the creatures Ezekiel saw, that's the famous Maaser Merkava, Ezekiel's chariot, where he saw the chariot with all the angels carrying the chariot. And first chapter of Ezekiel, he describes this incredible vision of the spiritual reality. So all of those creatures that Ezekiel saw, the boiling pot and the rod from an almond tree envisioned by Jeremiah, the scroll Ezekiel saw, and the measure seen by Zechariah, all of these were all metaphoric images. But they understood what it meant. The meaning was imprinted, as he said, upon their hearts. Similarly, some of the prophets would relate the allegory and its explanation. So when they talked it over, when they described it, some would relate the vision and the meaning. Others would relate only the explanation. Some would just tell you what the message was. Hey, God is telling you, you got to get your act together or else the temple is going to be destroyed. They didn't mention the vision that they saw, but the point is, God didn't communicate with them in a straightforward message. Does that make sense? God didn't say, tell the people they have to do this or that or the other. God showed them some sort of allegory, some sort of vision, gave them the meaning, and then they used their own words to describe it. At times, they would relate only the imagery without explaining it, as can be seen in some of the prophecies of Ezekiel and Zechariah. So again, Ezekiel and Zechariah in Hebrew. Ezekiel, as I mentioned, did speak about the vision of the divine chariot, whatever that means, with all the angels and all the beings, the celestial beings, but he doesn't explain what it means. And so that's why the Talmud says that if somebody is not ready for it, don't study Ezekiel's chariot, because it could create all sorts of questions about God that are not healthy. All the prophecies come in the form of metaphoric imagery and allegories. Make sense? Yeah. Well, listen, Maimonides mentioned it. But why? I don't know. Okay. I don't know. Why couldn't God tell them straight out what to say and they could say straight out what, you know?
I would never have thought to ask it.
No, it's a good question. I don't know. Definitely makes it more interesting. All the prophets do not prophesy whenever they desire. Instead, they must concentrate their attention upon spiritual concepts and seclude themselves, waiting, this is also interesting, waiting in a happy, joyous mood. Why? Because prophecy cannot rest upon a person when he is sad or languid, but only when he is happy. So divine spirit does not rest upon a person in a negative state, only in a positive, happy, upbeat state. Let's turn the page. Therefore, the prophet's disciples would always have a harp, drum, flute, and lyre before them when they were seeking prophecy. That was something to get the mood in a joyous state. We need some music. Interesting, right? This is what is meant by the expression. This is what is meant by the expression in Samuel. There should be we're missing a parenthesis over there. They were prophesying, i.e., following the path of prophecy until they would actually prophesy, as one might say, so and so aspires to greatness. In other words, precipitating the prophecy, they would try to get into a positive mood with music, and then that would help the experience. Those who aspire to prophecy are called the disciples of the prophets. even though they concentrate their attention, it is possible that the divine presence will rest upon them, and it is possible that it will not rest upon them. It could go either way. Let's continue, and here we get into Moses. All the statements made above describe the path of prophecy of all the early and later prophets, with the exception of Moses, our teacher, the master of all the prophets. What is the difference between Moses' prophecy and that of the other prophets? Divine insight is bestowed upon all the other prophets in a dream or a vision, as we said before, and not even straightforward, in an allegorical, metaphorical way. Moses, our teacher, by contrast, would prophesy while standing awake, as it states, when Moses came into the tent of meeting to speak to him, he heard the voice speaking to him. And the voice is not that show on NBC. The voice here is referring to the voice of God. And that's straight up from Numbers. So again, Moses' experience of prophecy is far different than any of the other prophets, even the ones that came before him. Abraham, Jacob, the patriarchs were prophets, the matriarchs were prophets, right? Different experience. Divine insight is bestowed upon all the other prophets through the medium of an angel, because their level of refinement is insufficient for them to receive the divine revelation openly. Therefore, the other prophets, perceive only metaphoric imagery and allegories which reflect the nature of that particular angel. Moses, our teacher, by contrast, would prophesy without the medium of an angel, as the verse states, mouth to mouth I speak to him. And also it states, and God spoke to Moses face to face, and he gazed upon the image of God, i.e., there was no metaphor. Rather, he would perceive the matter in its fullness, without metaphor or allegory. The Torah testifies concerning him, where God says, I speak to him manifestly without allegory, meaning his appreciation of prophecy would not be through metaphor, but through open revelation, appreciating the matter in its fullness. Make sense?
Doesn't that answer the question before that about saying it directly?
Yes.
Most people can't comprehend it.
Yes. In other words, why them? Through metaphor, because they were spiritually unable to have that type of direct communication. They were not spiritually fit. It had to go through a medium. It's almost like if you want to explain a deep concept to a child, you might tell the child the moral in the form of a story. Let me tell you a story, and the story contains the message. Well, why don't you? Or you teach a child mathematics, and you'll tell the kid two apples. Take two apples. Add another two apples. How many apples do you have? You make it tangible. You take a construct of 2 plus 2 equals 4, and you make it tangible in the form of apples. Why? Because you tell a 5-year-old, 2 plus 2 equals 4, they'll say, and my name is Eli Solish. Like, what are you saying, 2 plus 2 equals 4? Like, well, he's 4, so whatever. But, like, what are you saying? Like, 2 plus 2 equals 4? Like, Hava Nagila, cha-cha-cha. Like, what do those words mean, 2 plus 2 equals 4? It doesn't mean anything. 2 plus 2 equals 4? It's like an abstraction. Like, what is that? It's an abstraction. It's an abstract concept. But you say, 2 cups plus 2 fake... What are these? What are these?
Cacti.
Are these cacti succulents or cacti?
Succulents.
Succulents? I don't know. Who knows? It's plastic. That's what I definitely do know. So, 2 of these and 2 of these... Oh, 1, 2, 3, 4. I get it. There's 4 items here. But you just say, so for most prophets, Billy, you're right. For most, yeah, it's not. It's I don't think yours is alive. Yeah, no, yours is also faux. It makes...
Is there a problem with plastic being in here?
Say it again?
Is there a problem with plastic being in here?
I hope not. I don't know. I don't know. Although, yeah, who knows what it is. I don't know. It says, I don't know. We'll have to further investigate. But here, I'm with you. But here's the point. The other prophets were on a lower level. They needed the metaphor. They needed the story. They needed the vision of something else, and then like, and that's the message. Oh, I got it now. Moses could handle it straight up. He could handle the message directly. The other prophets, they needed something else. Erica?
So the paragraph you just read, where it says, and God spoke to Moses
face to face.
Is that theoretically?
Yes. That's what we're getting to. That's what we're trying to get to. Even when it comes to Moses, and God speaks to him face to face, what actually was happening? That's my question. After all this, what's happening? Does God have a mouth? Is God speaking in Hebrew? How is God communicating?
So when do we find out? I'm really
We still have like 18 minutes, 18 to 20 minutes. Hold on. We're getting there. The big reveal.
It does seem that the other prophecies sought out prophecy, but then God sought out Moses.
That's also true. Certainly. Well, some of the other prophets also God kind of jumped them. No, that sounds wrong. But God kind of like, hey, I need to speak to you for a second. Here's some weird metaphor, and here's the meaning. Go communicate this. So you do have other prophets that God kind of chose, but Moses, we know that story, right? Moses is doing his thing, shepherding animals, you know, whatever that is. And then God appears to him at the burning bush. He's like, I need you. Got to take my people out of Egypt. So yeah, definitely God chooses Moses. And it's on a completely different level. And in fact, where's my Torah? Where's my Bible? There's no chumashim in here. As I look around, they're upstairs in the synagogue now. But the last verse. Hold on. Let's see. No, that's a prayer book. Okay, anyway, the last few verses of the Torah, no, don't worry about it, it's fine. I'll make it up. I don't mind making up verses. It's fine. Wait, hold on. I'm getting something. Yeah, you don't know my new name. By the way, funny, this is serious business now. I have to tell you a story. So this is a metaphor, I'm joking. This is, when I was single, so my friends and I, we were contacted by some rabbis up in Montreal. Montreal. It's higher up, but it's not that high. So to do something called Exodus. No, it's not what you're thinking. It's not the original, but to do like a stage show, if you will, to like tell the story of the Exodus. And it was like before Passover. We took over. Anybody familiar with Montreal? Yes. Cavendish Mall. Okay, so it's a big mall. They had one of their anchor stores, like, you know, you would have, what's an anchor store, like at the end of a mall? Banana Republic, Macy's or Dillard's or whatever it was. So it was empty. They had, I guess, I don't know, whatever store was there. So we took over that whole space and we created a thing with real sets and special effects and all this stuff. And I was Moses. So I can't tell you more. No. I actually held a sheep or a lamb, I don't know what it was, something small. I held actual livestock for the performance. That was a real thing. Yeah. And I came in for the burning bush. I held holding a sheep or whatever it was. Anyway, those were the days. There is video footage. We have to look it up. I don't know if it's on YouTube. We can find it. Yeah. No, it was real, it was an actual animal. No, and then we did this, we rigged up the room, the throne room. There was a scene with, you know, me and Pharaoh, my good buddy. So Pharaoh was all decked out, Pharaoh gear, I was decked out of Moses gear, I had the staff, I had this.
Out of luck?
I have Pulket Torah.
You have the last verse? Pull up, if you don't, yeah, pull up the last, no, while you're at it, pull up the last few verses. But hold on, I'm Montreal here. So anyway, We rigged up I'll just tell you one anecdote. For the plague of frogs, we did different plagues. You have it? Perfect. Here we go. V'zot habracha. Okay, perfect. So Aliyah 7. Here it is. Okay. I'll get there in just a second. Let me finish it. So we rigged up frogs by lines, like a fishing line from the ceiling with a pulley system. So for the plague of frogs, I should explain. Who do we do this for? We did this for school kids, public school kids. We had like 20,000 kids.
Wow.
come through in the month before Passover. Every day there were like 5-6 shows of like hundreds of kids. Basically all the kids in Montreal, all school kids, whether they're in Jewish schools or public schools, they all came through. Like the public schools that had like lots of Jewish kids. Montreal's a big community, so they all came through this thing. And we did a special track. It was then when there was another famous song, Who Let the Dogs Out? You know that song? So we changed it to Who Let the Frogs Out? Who? And it was like the kids were shrieking and then they were laughing. Okay, here we go. The last, second to last, sorry, one, two, third to last verse of the Torah. V'lo kam navi od b'Yisrael k'moshe. There has never arisen another prophet in Israel like Moses. Asher yada'o Hashem panim upon him, that knew God face to face. Straight up. And all the wonders and the miracles that God sent him to do in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh and his servants in the land, and all of the great things and the great wonders that Moses did before the eyes of all Israel. But the point is that third to last verse of the Torah. Deuteronomy chapter 34, verse 10. No prophet ever arose like Moses who knew God, panim el panim, face to face. So, I mean, that's straight up in the Torah. We read it. It's the last, you see it right there. So Moses' prophecy is super, super unique. As Maimonides emphasizes here in this context, yeah.
I would think it'd just be the opposite, that it'd be more difficult to interpret a dream or a metaphor than it would be face-to-face.
But again, think about in the language of, think about in the context of education, educating a child. So again, you have an abstract concept. How do you explain an abstract concept to a child? You tell them a story. Or you concretize it. You take 2 plus 2 equals 4, which is a concept, and you turn into apples. 2 plus 2 equals 4 is not 4 apples. That's a concept. But you turn it into apples to make it tangible. I mean, think Sesame Street, right? You take numbers, you take letters, you take things, and you make it very simple. I mean, Sandy, speak to this. Putting you on the spot, right?
Yeah.
Sandy's our resident expert on all things education.
Oh, God, no. Oh, excuse me. Gosh, no.
Right, but the concept of taking ideas, abstract ideas, and making them...
But then there's also, though, what you have in here is like almost a degree of separation, because then you're explaining it, but the way in which a child or anyone is going to understand it is their way.
Right.
So if you sort of go from the way you're describing it, there's two degrees of separation. There's the one is the metaphor, and then there's the interpretation of the metaphor. And even the third then is your interpretation, and the third that you add onto it is the words that you use to interpret.
And then there's the person that's hearing from the prophet, and then there's like what message are they getting at the end of all of this?
Right.
So that's why it's diluted from the original through multiple stages, whereas Moses' prophecy, since he was on a higher level, it was the direct message, straight up. And I understand what you're saying, that the metaphor might be harder to interpret, but the point is, it's more clouded, because the other prophets were not on such a high level.
So they're assuming that we, after seeing the metaphor, we say, oh yeah, I know what that means.
Kind of. And hopefully they got the right message.
So but even in the term, I mean, the face-to-face, I would wonder if that is actually, even if it's in the Torah, but it's not literal face-to-face.
Right, and that's what Erica was asking. So we're going to get there in a second. So let's finish this, and then let's get to what does face-to-face mean. All right, all of the other prophets, we're on the third page now. All the other prophets are overawed, terrified, and confounded by the revelations they experience. No, I'm sorry. When I say third page, I mean the third side. 1, 2, 3 at the bottom of the third side. They're overawed, terrified, and confounded by the revelations. But Moses, our teacher, would not respond in this manner. As the Torah relates, God spoke to Moses as a man speaks to his friend. Again, Exodus 33:11. Just as a person will not be awestruck from hearing his friend's words, so too Moses' mental power was sufficient to comprehend the words of prophecy while he was standing in a composed state. Again, incredible to imagine this. All of the other prophets cannot prophesy whenever they desire. Moses, our teacher, was different. Whenever he desired, the divine spirit would envelop him and prophecy would rest upon him. He did not have to concentrate his attention to prepare himself for prophecy because his mind was always concentrated, prepared, and ready to appreciate spiritual truth as the angels are. Therefore, he would prophesy at all times as the verse states, stand and hear what God will command you. He was promised this by God as implied by the verse that says, go and tell them, return to your tents, but you stand here together with me. This should be interpreted to mean that when prophecy departs, all the other prophets, they would return to their tents, i.e. the needs of the body, like other people. Therefore, they did not separate themselves from their wives. Moses, our teacher, never returned to his original tent. Therefore, he separated himself from women and everything of that nature forever. He bound his mind to the eternal rock. Accordingly, the glory never left him forever. The flesh of his countenance shone, for he became holy like the angels. So yeah, and there is a tradition that says that Moses, post his prophetic experience at Sinai, he separated from his wife. And that's another story unto itself. And in fact, there's an episode where Miriam and Aaron, his sister and brother, are talking about him, Moses, and God says, you shouldn't be speaking about your brother behind his back. What were they speaking about? Well, they were saying, we're prophets and we're still married. Both Aaron and Miriam, brother and sister, they were also prophets and they were still married and they went to their tent, so to speak, you know, euphemistically. And so how come Moses separated from his, you know, wasn't with, you know, his wife? And God says, don't get involved with Moses. Don't speak about Moses because he's on a completely different level. His prophecy, and that's where some of these verses come from, his prophecy is on a completely different level. And on that level, he is not like your average human being. Okay.
No, how about not like your average prophet?
Or your average prophet, right. You're your average prophet human being, exactly. Number seven. There is the possibility that a prophet will experience prophecy for his own sake alone, i.e. to broaden his perspective and to increase his knowledge, allowing him to know more about lofty concepts than he knew before. So prophecy could just be a mind-expanding experience where the prophet is given a vision of stuff that he or she never knew before. It is also possible that he will be sent to one of the nations of the world or to the inhabitants of a particular city or kingdom to prepare them and to inform them what they should do or to prevent them from continuing the evil which they are doing. So either the prophet could be getting a message for themselves, wisdom for themselves, or could be being conveyed a message to relay to a specific people. When he is sent on such a mission, he is given a sign or wonder to perform so that the people will know that God has truly sent him. Not everyone who performs signs or wonders should be accepted as a prophet, however. Only a person who is known to be fit for prophecy beforehand, i.e. his wisdom and his good deeds surpass those of his contemporaries, that is someone that we know to be a bona fide prophet, and with the sign, which means a miracle, then you accept it. If he follows the path of prophecy and holiness, separating himself from worldly matters, and afterwards performs a sign or wonder and states that he was sent by God, it is a mitzvah to listen to him, as the verse states, listen to him, Deuteronomy. It is possible that a person will perform a sign or wonder even though he is not a prophet. Rather, the wonder will have another cause behind it. This is because signs and wonders, and even divining the future, can be performed by sorcery and the like, as explained in chapters 8 through 10, which we don't have here. It is nevertheless a mitzvah to listen to him, since he is a wise man of stature and fit for prophecy. We accept his prophecy as true. All right, let's continue on the last page. This is the nature of the Torah's commandment. To give an example of a parallel, we are commanded to render a legal judgment based on the testimony of two witnesses, even though they may testify falsely. Since we know them to be acceptable as witnesses, we presume that they are telling the truth. In other words, how do you ever know that any witnesses are telling the truth? You never know. What they might have concocted a story and worked to get their story straight to the point that they can withstand cross-examination. But you never really know. Torah says, though, if two witnesses come and you cross-examine them and it's legit, and it seems legit, you have to accept it, even though you don't know 100%. Same thing with prophecy. If the person is of an upright character, with good deeds, they're pious, they're a good person, and they come with signs and miracles, and they speak something that they say is a prophecy, there's a mitzvah to believe this person, given all those factors. Even though you don't know 100%, because how do you know that they actually heard something? They could have made it up. But if all the other factors are there, then you accept it. Considering these matters and the like, the Torah states, the hidden matters are for God. our Lord, but what is revealed is for us and our children, and man sees what is revealed to the eyes, but God sees into the heart. In other words, only God knows what's lurking in the heart of somebody. So could it be that this prophet is making up a story and is not sincere, is not legit? Yeah, but only God knows that truth. We have to go by what our eyes see and what our senses dictate. And if a person checks off all those boxes, then you accept it as a prophecy. Okay, now we get to our question. The question is, so, after all is said and done, how does God actually communicate? Whether it's Moses directly face-to-face, or even the other prophets that were shown some sort of metaphor or allegory, what did they actually receive? Did they hear a voice? Were they told a story? Were they shown a vision? And if they were shown a vision, was it like a dream? What was it like? So one of the core ideas of our text is that God created the world through language. That God spoke, and it's from the Torah itself. God said, let there be light, and there was light. God said, let there be a heaven, there was a heaven, etc. God said, let us make man. And God's been wondering, second-guessing ever since, was that actually good? Kidding. Right, God said, let us make man, and human beings emerged. Language is the code of creation. And as we've said throughout this series, it's been a few weeks only, but throughout these few weeks, and as I said earlier today, not only is language the original code of creation, it's constantly the code of existence. Because it's not like creation happened once upon a time and things just keep on going because they were already started that way. But everything at every moment only exists because it's constantly being encoded into being. And if for a moment you erase the code, that thing, that reality, ceases to be a reality, ceases to exist. See, here's the question. When God said, let there be light, or more relevant today, God's words, let there be light, that are hanging in the universe now, giving light its existence, what does that sound like? Can you hear it? Does God articulate that as audible sounds? Let there be light? We can't hear it, certainly, but aside from our limitations, does God speak those words like you and I understand speaking? The answer is no. Because God doesn't have a mouth. And God doesn't speak as we speak. In fact, it's explained in Kabbalah that why do we use the term speaking altogether with God? Because that's the way we understand revelation. How do you take something that's in your head and share it with someone else? You have an idea, you have a feeling, and you want to share it with someone else. Typically, how do you do it? Through language. Either you say it, or you write it. That's how you communicate. You feel love for someone else. How do you communicate it? Okay, there's also nonverbal communication with love, fine. Okay, let's say you have an idea, you have a new theory, you want to communicate it. How do you communicate it? Typically through speech, or through writing it, which is the same thing, it's through letters. So the Kabbalists explain that when we use the language of speech with God, what it means is revelation. It doesn't necessarily mean speech like you and I speak. It means taking something that was hidden and revealing it. So God's speech, let there be light, is in essence taking the hidden capacity, the potential for light, and making it manifest using certain forms of energy. In the form, he says, of language. But not verbally articulated language, But the language, it's almost like, you see, we don't want to make this so abstract that we do away with the language altogether, with God. Because at the end of the day, we said, and we say in Kabbalah, that the Hebrew letters that are at the source of creation are carrying that energy into that being. But again, it's not verbally communicated like you and I communicate language. It's not the same way. In other words, imagine if I could somehow telepathically convey my thoughts or an idea that I have into your mind or onto your heart. An idea that I have into your mind or a feeling that I have into your heart. And I could somehow project it, imprint it upon you without opening up my mouth, without writing anything, without you even seeing my body language from a completely different room. Imagine I'm in one room, door is closed, you're in another room, and suddenly you know what I'm thinking or you feel how I feel. You would still feel that or know that in the form of letters because we always think in the construct of language, right? We think in the construct of letters and language. So we're thinking. We get this idea and we know it's coming from this other person, but we get this idea, it takes root within us as language. But it's not communicated. Again, this is obviously it's a made-up example. Because I don't think this exists yet where we can like telepathically beam our thoughts to someone else. Right? It's not a thing yet. But the recipient would still get the sense of language. And it would be conveyed from a place of language to a place of language without using the actual verbal articulation of language. So God creates the world and recreates it constantly through language, but not necessarily in a spoken language. Even though we say God speaks existence into being, but it's not necessarily a spoken language like you and I speak. Make sense?
Someone else, but what you're describing too is that it's really that idea, and then the idea then gets, it's like with the metaphor, is that it gets translated into.
But here's the interesting thing: Kabbalah talks about how creation of a finite environment requires finite containers like letters, like language. In other words, it's not just the idea that God is communicating. Remember, the idea is the idea of creation of light, but light is a finite substance. It has parameters, it has a definition, which is articulated by or conveyed by letters, which themselves are limitations. In other words, it's not like the idea. What you're saying is, theoretically, you can just communicate the idea without language, without letters, but that would be an existence that's so abstract and so infinite that it's not the tangible universe that we know. So God's creating, does this make sense? God's creating a finite universe utilizing a medium that is likewise finite and definitive, right? A limitation using a medium that is a limitation as opposed to something that's more open. So to convey just an open idea would represent God's infinite ability, if you will, but conveying it in the form of letters and language, even if it's not verbally communicated, like we know verbal communication, conveys the notion that this revelation is of a finite form, creating a finite universe with hard limitations. Light is not darkness. I saw yesterday, where was it? What was it? I saw a book, Dr. Seuss. I was reading to my kids. They chose this really random Dr. Seuss book, which is The Cat in the Hat, trivia. You know this one? It's The Cat in the Hat. Hey, Ellie Solish. So it's a cat. It's a Cat in the Hat question and answer book. Does anybody know this one? It's a very. It's a little bit bizarre. Yeah, it's like hard. Like what's your zip code? No. Now I'm asking you. It's like in the. It's like 100 questions, and one of them is like, "What's your zip code?" And like, but one of the cute ones was if we have flashlights that light up the dark, are there dark lights that darken the light? And it shows like two pictures. One of like a dark room with a flashlight beam making it light, and another one like a bright room with a darkness emanating. And I read it to Ellie, who was right there a moment ago. And he says, I said, is that possible? He's like, no, it's not possible. Why is that not possible? Why is it that in a dark room, you turn on the light and immediately the darkness vanishes, but if you have a light room and you bring in a little darkness, it won't do anything, right?
Bring in darkness.
That's the point. You can't, right? You can't bring in darkness into a light room because if the light's there, the darkness doesn't exist, right? Why is that? Because that's the parameters that God created with light and darkness. Light has its property. Darkness is its property. But that's how God created with a certain structure. And it doesn't have the opposite structure. All of that is articulated by the concept or by the notion that God spoke existence into being. And God speaks constantly existence into being, utilizing language and utilizing verbal articulation. And so the point here is, and we're at time now, but we're not going to read it inside. Next week we'll read it inside, where he says, basically, as God speaks constantly existence into being, it's not through the language, it's not verbally articulated through a mouth, like we speak, and it's not done in the same exact way as we know, but it's still a revelation utilizing limitation, and what we call it, the way we refer to it is the limitations of language. What's the moral of the story? Number one, prophecy. Let me know how that works out for you. Let me know if it catches on, if it takes this week. Let me know what you hear, if it's interesting. Number one. Number two, again, I think the prevalent theme here is being in awe of existence, not taking existence for granted. Just because you see it doesn't mean it should be here. It means that God is making it be here. And what that does is it changes so many things. Number one, a challenge maybe is not such a challenge, because if God's creating it now, maybe I look at it as an opportunity. My past need not define my future, because whatever was has already been uncreated, and whatever is right now is not the same old. Right? I don't wake up to the same old reality. It's a brand new reality. It might look the same, but it's like frames of a film. Each frame is distinct. This is a brand new moment, a brand new creation. And I can transform this moment in a brand new way than anything I've done before if I see myself as brand new as well. These are just some practical ramifications of this notion of constant creation. Thank you very much for joining me this morning for Kabbalah and Coffee.